Okay. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for the organizers for inviting me to talk about what we are doing in our lab with laboratory experiments and numerical simulations. And I will be talking about the flow of viscous heterogeneities in mantle plume. Now, the idea of studying heterogeneities which are compositionally or intrinsically more viscous has been around for many years, and in the 90s, Thorsten Becker, who is here, proposed this model where in the lower mantle you might have blobs of more viscous material. And the focus at the time was to try to understand how can we preserve geochemical reservoirs. Because if you have more viscous heterogeneities, does it work? If you have more viscous heterogeneities, then they wouldn't deform that much. So even at the time, it was clear that the origin of these viscosity differences was an open question. Today, we know that viscosity can depend on the grain size, namely on the square of a grain size for diffusion creep. It depends, of course, on the water content and on rock composition. And concerning rock composition, this is a slide that we have already seen today. Rock composition is really, really complex because if you're looking now, this is now depth on this axis. This diagram gives the phase proportions for pyrolytic mantle. This is the upper mantle, the lower mantle, and note the differences with respect to this figure, which gives Harzburgite and basalt. In the upper mantle, we have fundamental differences in the garnet content, which is, we think we know, more viscous, more stiff. In the lower mantle, it's an open problem because, for example, for basalt, which turns into eclogite, you have a high proportion of calcium perovskite, and Stixrud and collaborator found that this would give a sort of weakening, at least in terms of seismic velocities, but then it's difficult to move from seismic velocities to viscosity. So all in all, we all used a sort of fluid dynamics perspective, just saying, well, let's put a blob and see what happens without actually asking or answering too much what is the mineral physics, what is the composition. But this is difficult, and maybe this is also a message for people doing studying viscosity. So, and this was also the approach by Mike Manga. So here we have, let's say, the mantle. The flow inside of this box is driven by a surface velocity, so it's a kinematic model. And then we put a blob, which is lambda times more viscous than the surrounding material. And I will use over and over this non-dimensional ratio, so pay attention. This is lambda, is a viscosity of heterogeneity over the viscosity of a surrounding fluid. So for example, here we have a blob with a lambda equal 10. And what we see is that the blob can go all around one over turn in the mantle, and eventually is not really too much deformed. Now, if we, Manga, repeat the same exercise for a blob with lambda equal 1, meaning it has the same viscosity as the surrounding mantle, the blob goes around, and of course that's the final shape after 1 over turn. Here it is. It is certainly more deformed than if lambda equal 10, but not that much. So the question I asked is this model representative of deformation in mantle plumes? And the answer is no, because we know this. We showed with numerical models years ago with Al Hoffman, and now with Angela Limar, we conducted laboratory experiments. Here you see a plume conduit. This is a plume head, and we are able to inject a finite volume like heterogeneity, and this is a passive, so lambda equal 1, and we see what happens. Well, as it rises in the plume conduit, it gets stretched. You see, it forms a very long filament. So the bottom line here is that Manga's model cannot be representative of a flow inside the mantle plume. And this is because inside the mantle plume, we have a profile. This is the plume axis, imagine. This is a radius. The vertical velocity profile is exponentially decaying with a square of a radius. And when you calculate the derivative of this velocity, so dvz over dr, this is the strain rate you get, which is clearly neither constant nor linear. So there are some specific aspects of Mantle plumes which I find very interesting. First of all, the flow inside the Mantle plume often shows very high strain rates. We are talking about 10 to the minus 13, 10 to the minus 14 seconds minus 1, even in the lower mantle. These are asthenospheric values, okay? The second interesting aspect of a flow inside the mantle plume is that the deformation history is complex. You have material flowing towards the base of a plume, towards the conduit, and at that time we undergo pure shear. We will see it in a second. Once the material upwells inside the conduit, we undergo simple shear. So the history of deformation is not so simple, okay? And by doing this, generally we rule out a lot of commonly used assumptions in fluid mechanics, of course, which are very important and very useful, but like low deformation, low and linearly varying strain rates, same type of flow, etc., we cannot apply this anymore. So, key point, there is something specific that we need to study in mantle plumes. Does this mean that all previous literature is useless? Well, of course not. And to convince you of this, I showed a figure from a paper by Taylor in 1934. And Taylor conceived very intelligent laboratory experiments where you have a sort of roll mill device, whatever. It turns here the rolls. So the flow that you generate, I plot it here, is a typical flow for pure shear flow. And you put in a viscous drop. At the time, it was called viscous drop, with a viscosity which is 20 times higher than the surrounding fluid. And what they observe is that the drop is actually deformed. It gets elongated until it bursts. Now, you repeat the same exercise, the same blob, but you put it in a simple shear flow, which is generated with this device, like this, and what they observe is that the drop simply rotates. It doesn't deform, it simply rotates. This is the effect of viscosity. It is faster to rotate than to get stretched. Of course, these experiments have a constant strain rate, so it's interesting, but it's not the whole story. So the questions that we wanted to address are, how are viscous heterogeneities deformed once they are in a plume conduit? How is a plume's flow perturbed by the viscous heterogeneity? It's like a coupling between the two. They are not totally independent. The other aspects which could be more interesting also for a geochemist is that we all know, and we talked about it today, that if we have in a mantle lateral viscosity variations, then even a purely poloidal buoyancy-driven flow would generate or would have appeared a toroidal component. So lateral viscosity variations help a toroidal component to appear. So the question was, can we also have the appearance of a toroidal flow component inside a mantle plume, which is clearly a poloidal buoyancy-driven flow? And this aspect was interesting because a few years ago, Blischertoft and Albaret, so geochemists, proposed that there could be a toroidal component inside the plume that would mix the heterogeneities. So the question is there radial or azimuthal mixing inside the conduit? Could it be due to viscosity differences? Now, in order to address these questions, we conducted both laboratory experiments and numerical simulations. I will show the numerical simulations. So I have 3D numerical simulation of my mantle plume. It's fairly simple model with the code by Paul Tackley. We have temperature-dependent viscosity. Right now, these models are for an incompressible model. We generate a plume, very simple plume, and then I introduce an heterogeneity. And this heterogeneity for me has a very simple, very basic initial shape of a sphere, say of a radius of 40 kilometers. I put it there, I model it with millions of tracers, and have a look at what happens. Now, if a sphere is passive, so it doesn't have any viscosity difference with respect to the surrounding fluid, we get filaments. We know this. We have seen it over and over. If a sphere is 20 times more viscous than the surrounding material, then we observe that this sphere actually rises and doesn't deform much, basically keeps its spherical shape. Note also that the rising times are quite slow compared to what a filament would do. So the first question is, how does this blob affect the velocity field? Now here we take, this is a section, this is the plume axis. So this is depth on this axis. Here is our blob. Now if we look at this axis, we have a vertical velocity. Without the blob, the vertical velocity is the one shown in green, which is perfectly symmetric. However, with the blob, the vertical velocity is the one shown in black, where we see a significant velocity reduction both inside the blob and also inside in the conduit here, and the symmetry is actually lost. The interesting part is that when we calculate the derivative, basically dvz over dx, which corresponds to a major component of a strain rate, this is what we find. We find that inside the blob, the strain rate is incredibly low and then increases rapidly outside in the part of a conduit. So, and this would be the strain rate without the blob. So the question is, of course, we have seen that the vertical velocity is perturbed. Now we are in an incompressible flow, so variation in the vertical velocity would induce also variations in the horizontal velocity. And indeed, what we see here I simply plot my blob here, and I simply show horizontal components, which of course are much weaker than the vertical component, but yet they appear. They wouldn't be there without the blob, okay? They appear because the blob actually slows down the whole upwelling in the column and forces the fluid to deviate in this direction. So we see the trajectories that are actually deviated out of the axis. And then once a blob, this sort of obstacle, it's over, the flow goes back to this direction, okay? We can also plot, have a look what happens on some horizontal sections. For example, right beneath the blob, we have it here. So this is now a view on the conduit. Indeed, we have flow moving away from the blob and towards the plume axis. And when we are up here above the blob, the fluid flow is somewhat in the opposite direction. So, and the colors, I didn't say, but the colors correspond to vorticity, which can help to then calculate the toroidal component. But the bottom line of this is, I think, that we can say that the flow inside the conduit is actually perturbed over a vertical distance, which corresponds roughly to 3 times the blob diameter. However, this perturbation has somewhat a local character, so it goes out and comes back, without any permanent interconduit mixing. So there could be some mixing, but it's local. The other aspect now is try to understand why this blob actually turns. And I remind you very simple textbook cases. If you have a solid body rotation, like the wheel of your bicycle, this is the velocity that you would have if you put all the velocities equal to zero at the center. If you have a simple shearing, this is a basic velocity field. So the question is, what is the velocity field inside our blob? Well, here it is. This is the plume axis. The color code helps you to see the rotation. This is now the velocity field calculated with respect to a zero velocity here at the center. Now we see that the blob actually deforms and it rises, but we also have an horizontal component at the bottom, a horizontal component at the top, and all in all, the blob simply turns and doesn't deform. For lambda equal 10, we have what we call a transitional case, which was never seen before. And basically, we see the formation of something somewhat transitional, where the lower part actually has a structure, typical structure of a blob with internal rotation, whereas the narrow part that rises undergoes simple shearing. Here you see the velocity field, but also there is also a component of elongation because the bottom part doesn't rise as fast as the top part. So whatever rises here is doomed to get stretched over and over. Okay, so we can ask the question, first of all, how can we define deformations? Because these are bodies with a very irregular shape. So we decided to conceive a ratio, which is a surface of heterogeneities at a given time over the surface of initial sphere. And this is plotted here. And here we have a viscosity ratio, lambda. So for the case I showed you before, in blue, so the radius of 40 kilometers, we see that the more the viscosity, the less, of course, the deformation, until we end up where we have a blob-like type of heterogeneity. If we increase the radius of heterogeneity, we will predict more deformation, even at the same viscosity. If we decrease the size, so a smaller size blob with respect to the scale of a flow that generates the deformation, then we would have, at a given viscosity ratio, for example, less deformation. So smaller heterogeneities are more easily preserved as blobs with respect to bigger heterogeneities. The other question was, what about the strain rate of our plume? Does it play a role? And until now, I've shown you all calculations that were conducted for an activation energy E equal to 120 kilojoule per mole, which is maybe reasonable for the lower mantle, but one can ask, what if we have higher values, let's say 300? So this is technically what we do. We change the activation energy in our models, and we see, with respect to the viscosity ratio of our blob, here is 40 kilometers diameter radius, what happens. And basically you see that as you increase the activation energy, then the stability field of a blob-like is pushed to higher values of the viscosity ratios. Contrary, if you decrease activation energy, then we find values around 4, only lambda around 4, above which the blob could be preserved, and this is actually in good agreement with Mike's manga models. The other aspect that is interesting is that when we play this game of changing the activation energy, I do see that my plume rises with higher vertical velocities because the temperature-dependent viscosity is weaker. So there is a higher vertical velocity inside the conduit and therefore even higher buoyancy flux of a plume. So this could suggest that filament-like heterogeneities would prevail in very vigorous plumes, which we would find somewhat up here, for example, in Hawaii, whereas plumes with a low buoyancy flux, for example, around here, would tend to preserve blob-like heterogeneities more easily. So what happens now once our blobs or our zoo of shapes gets to the plume head where we have a melting zone? This is a case for radius 30 kilometers. We have the blobs, the filament, the transitional shape. Of course, they have different shapes, and they will cross the melting zone with different time scales. And here we plot, for example, the elapsed time versus the fraction of this blob that could fill the magma chamber beneath a volcano. And we see that the blob, basically, since it is compact, would cross the melting zone very rapidly in half a million years, would actually fill the whole magma chamber, so it would have an important effect on magmatism seen by the volcano. For transitional, we have something like a precursors, and then the blob part arrives. For the filament instead, we have a filament that goes through long time and not so much volume is affected any time. Now the question is, if our blob is more fertile, compositionally more fertile, then the presence could actually enhance melting. If instead the blob is less fertile, The presence of a blob, more viscous blob, could maybe actually reduce or shut off melt production. And I was actually thinking about a hotspot in the Polynesian area, which are fairly weak, that have a volcanic activity that is somewhat scattered over time, is not as regular as Hawaii. So all these hotspots could be good candidates to be profoundly affected by the arrival of a more viscous blob inside the melting zone. Now, very rapidly, if we play this game of asking, well, how is melting affected and so on, we have to start thinking about composition and therefore density. So this is the next step. Here we have a viscosity ratio. I will only show the case for viscosity ratio equal 1 and equal 20 for a given blob size. And on this axis now, we have a buoyancy ratio. It's exactly the buoyancy ratio Anne was talking about. So is a chemical density over excess, over the thermal density excess. Now this dashed line gives you B equal 1. So when we are looking at cases up here, the chemical composition, delta rho chemical, is actually higher than the thermal. In some way, there would be no reason for this stuff to rise. Down here, instead, chemical is simply greater than 0. So we have run all these calculations, and we all find blobs. And I will show you a blob here, this example. Okay, so this is our plume axis. I don't show the plume. I only show the plume axis. These are elapsed times in million years. In orange here, there is a melting zone. Now, our viscous heterogeneity is 20 times more viscous. Composition is denser, B equal 0.8. And we see that the sphere actually gets deformed, but eventually rises and somewhat preserves its blob-like shape, even when it crosses the melting region. If we now move to, again, viscosity ratio 20, but B ratio higher than 1, what we get is a sort of fat, I called it fat tendril. And here it is. Now, this stuff is more viscous, but is also very denser, so it moves towards the plume conduit. And now, since it is more viscous, it doesn't spread readily as denser material would do. It stays somewhat compact, and eventually it starts to rise by viscous coupling. It is more viscous, it can rise by viscous coupling, and here it is, it rises, it takes awfully long time to rise, okay? So this would be really comparable nearly with the lifetime of a plume, but eventually, if we give it time to rise, eventually it will get to the melting zone, and here it is, 100% up there. And this is in striking contrast with a case where you have the same B, we are the same here, but now our viscosity ratio is equal to 1, so there is no viscosity difference. What does it do? Well, it's somewhat similar to what Anne showed. We have a finite size heterogeneities. It is taken by the flow towards the plume axis, and here somewhat it spreads. It forms a sort of base with a cusp, and only a thin tendril is able to rise and keeps rising. It's very, very thin, okay? This is roughly 30% of a whole material that gets up there, and eventually gets up there to the melting region and rises right at the center of a plume conduit. Okay, now we have run also other cases where you have even higher values of B. I don't show them, but they are thin tendril, and at that point there is no difference between viscosity or not. And this is all cases where the initial zonation is lost. So the blob was, for example, at the left of a plume conduit. We will find this material at the center. And very rapidly, I will show only this case with B equals 0.6 and no viscosity differences. And these are laboratory experiments that we conducted with a tank filled of syrups and so on. So basically, I skip the details, but we are able to inject the heterogeneities, which is here. Now this is only B equals 6. What happens? The heterogeneity is there. It starts to rise here. keeps rising. Now, this whole material is actually denser, so the velocity right at the axis are actually reduced. So the fastest part of this material that is rising is actually slightly off axis. The material rises, here you see it, and it spreads. Oula. Okay, now very briefly, 30 seconds. Anyway, Dominique Weiss will talk about this. Why do we care if the zonation is preserved or not? Well, because one way to explain geochemical differences in Hawaii is to think that the lower trend is actually sampling part of a large low shear velocity province. And what we find, and this is my conclusion, that the initial zonation is actually preserved if a finite size heterogeneity is more viscous and if it has a buoyancy ratio up to 0.8. For all other cases where the buoyancy ratio is greater than 1, then independently of a viscosity ratio, the zonation will be lost because this material would rise at the plume axis. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.